choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be out? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 182 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 9, Lunar Module Maneuvers Part 3. We ended the previous episode, number 181, with McDivitt and Swigert in the lunar module preparing for the firing of the descent module's engine. Here's Walter Cronkite to explain what's going to happen next.
The next big operation on the in the space flight of Apollo 9 is a very critical one. It comes about 3 hours from now. I think it's scheduled around 12:45 noon. And at that time, they are for the first time going to fire the lunar module descent stage engine. This is showing, this animation showing that engine firing right now. That engine is throttleable. Which is a kind of an interesting word to try to say early in the morning anyway, but it is throttleable. It goes from 1,050 pounds of thrust to 9,870 pounds of thrust and can be operated just like any other engine that can be speeded up or slowed down. This engine is most critical because this is the engine that will lower the lunar module, both the descent stage and the ascent stage, hooked together to the moon's surface from the orbit around the moon of some 59 miles. It will lower the spacecraft slowly to the moon, and then by adjusting that throttle, they will set down very, very carefully on the moon's surface. The engine also could be used even before that as an emergency backup power system to get the spacecraft out of lunar orbit and into the trans-Earth trajectory to bring it back home. You remember in the flight of Apollo 9, where they did not carry this lunar module, this was a critical point in that flight because they had only the service propulsion system engine to get them started back home again. Well, on a moon mission with the lunar module, they could use this engine also as a backup if the SPS engine was not working to bring them home, provided, of course, it had not previously been used to get to the moon, because the lunar module descent stage stays on the moon. Now, if it does have enough fuel remaining, it also could be used to lift back off of the moon, but it might not have that fuel available anyway. That would again be a backup system. The lunar module ascent stage is supposed to take the spaceman back from the moon's surface to the orbiting spaceship and leave the descent stage on the moon. That engine on our model over here is right at the bottom, of course, of the lunar module descent stage. This is the descent stage beginning with this flat platform here, and there is the engine right down there at the bottom. You can just about see it there. That engine, as I said, 1,050 to 1,950 pounds of thrust. The engine on the lunar module ascent stage as a 3,500-pound thrust engine. That is used to get the men back off of the descent stage, which becomes the launch platform for the men leaving the moon's surface and going back to the orbiting spaceship. The this engine will function today around 12:45 after the men have checked out all of the systems aboard the spacecraft. Then, with that test, they will fire it up and really give it a pretty good firing, because they will impart 1,714 feet per second to their speed. That's 1,165 miles an hour, and that's a pretty good jolt with that engine. It will give a pretty good test to the whole structure here when they fire off the engine with that much power, and it will have an effect of actually changing the orbit of the spacecraft. It will move the orbit of 6 degrees to the east. The spacecraft at that time will be making a pass over the United States. It'll be up north, around over Charleston or somewhere in that area, And at that time, they will fire this engine with the spacecraft is called out of plane, out of the orbital plane. And when they do, it'll just jar them over some 6 degrees. And that's quite a long way on the map. If you take a look at it, it's a good sizable change in their orbit. This is not only a test for them, but it has a practical effect of moving the orbit plane to a point where other maneuvers will take place in light or dark as they want them to take place. It will change the perigee also by a couple of miles, that is the low point of their orbit, and the new orbit will be 132 by 310 miles. The spaceman, after this maneuver today, will continue to work for a while in the spacecraft, not for very much longer, and then they will crawl back into the command module there to eat and to rest and to get another night's sleep.
Now here's a clip on how that throttleable engine is supposed to work.
Well, what they mean by the throttleable engine is that we can change the percent of thrust. Now, the way this will be controlled is by two modes, one by the computer here, known as the DISCI, and the other one by the commander's hand controller on my left side, which is very similar to what you have there.
Right.
They will start the engine. It'll go up to approximately 10% thrust when it starts, and then manually it will be taken up to about 40%. From there, the program will take it further to 100% thrust.
Automatically, then back down to 40, and then they go back and forth a little bit, getting their readings, you told me earlier, up here.
Yes.
So it's going to be a pretty thorough workout for that engine, Walter, as you said, the first throttleable engine in space.
When McDivitt was sure the systems were operating properly, he asked Scott to put the command module into neutral control so he could check out the lunar module steering system. McDivitt then operated the small thrusters to get the docked vehicles, both command's service module and lunar module, into the correct position for firing the lunar module's throttleable descent propulsion system. The small thrusters performed excellently and the lunar module was ready for the big test. Seconds after starting the large descent engine, McDivitt shouted, quote, "Look at that attitude ball! We hardly have any errors," end quote. 26 seconds later, at full thrust, he reported that errors were still practically non-existent. Then it was time to throttle down. Remember, the capability to throttle down was absolutely mandatory in the final seconds before landing on the moon. Mission Control, along with the astronauts, held their breath while McDivitt throttled down the lander. Mission Control telemetry showed the engine responding exactly as it should. The lunar module appeared to be a dependable machine. Here's a clip of the astronauts communicating with Mission Control during the burn.
Okay, there's ignition. Go all the way up to 40%, Dave. It's 40%. Okay, stand by for the autothrottle. Descent reg light now.
Going down.
Pressure's going down. Here comes the throttle up. Okay, pressure dropped down to about 190 there, Houston.
All right, we copied it, Spider.
We're full throttle and empty areas are practically nil, Davey.
Okay, looks pretty good over here, too.
Yeah, just a slight is empty.
Okay, your HP is 109 and holding.
Roger. You've got 440 to go.
I got 443.
I'm pulling 0.8 of a lunar G in case you're interested. We're starting to get a little excursion in my yaw.
All right,
Scavenger. Can't see much out the tail end here.
We just threw a big hump down at the ground there. We built another hump.
Yeah, I saw a few pieces go too. Okay, I got 405.
Roger, so do we. And the pings and the ags are counting down right together.
Okay, 109.3 on the HP.
Roger.
Now here's Walter Cronkite reporting the success of the burn, along with some comments from Grumman.
It is a mark of the smoothness of this first major test of the lunar module descent engine that even as the burn was taking place, and it lasted over 6 minutes, considerably increasing the speed of the spacecraft by 1,165 miles an hour and actually changing its orbital plane,
Right in the middle of that, Commander Jim McDivitt said, "Boy, am I hungry." And even later on, he complained again about his extreme hunger. He said that he was about to starve up there, and that just as soon as this part of the operation was over, he was going to take some time out and have a meal, one of the prepared meals that they carry aboard, of course. What was happening there, as you saw, to repeat again, was the first test of this throttleable the engine on the descent stage, which will eventually lower man from the command ship 59 miles down to the surface of the Earth. The engine works from 1,000 pound thrust up to 9,500 pounds of thrust, and today, as you heard, they were throttling it up through 10% and up into 40% of its maximum power to boost the spacecraft into an orbit some 360 miles east of the orbit it had previously been in. They're at an altitude between 132 at the low point and 310 miles high. As that burn, as the firing of the engines is called, continued, it went perfectly successfully, and right at the end of the maneuver, ground control called up and said, "It's a beautiful burn. You are right down the tube." And David Scott said from the command ship, "It looked good up here," and from the LEM, the similar words of encouragement that this first test of the engine had gone exceedingly well. One small cloud on the horizon. Schweikert earlier today had a little nausea, some space sickness of some kind, motion sickness perhaps. At any rate, a nausea that they are now studying. And if he does not have any further recurrence of that, the mission will go on as planned. If he does, there may be some change in the plan for his spacewalk scheduled for tomorrow. Now let's go out to Grumman Aircraft on Long Island, where Steve Rowan and Scott McCloud are standing by to show us what transpired this morning in this maneuver.
Walter, no one more interested, of course, than the folks here at Lemon Grumman, who built the LEM in that burn. And Scotty McCloud, perhaps you can show us just how the burn went. It was both manually and automatically controlled, correct?
Yes, it was, Steve. They start the burn by entering the requirements into the computer that you see here in front. Then, when the engine has started and gets up to about 10%, the commander would use his thrust controller over my left side, very similar to the one you have there, and he would increase, after a short period of time, the thrust level to about 40% manually. Then he stands by and holds 40%, and the computer catches up to him, goes on to 100% burn. Then he brings it back down in the neighborhood of 40% again. And the control is passed back and forth so that they can exercise both the automatic control of the burn and the manual control of the burn.
Scotty, why do you start at 10% with a descent stage engine burn?
Well, we have a gimbaled engine in the descent engine, and if it's possibly off-center when they're initializing the burn, then it would give a pitching moment. We hold it at 10% to allow it to come back to center.
From everything you heard, it was a pretty successful burn?
Very successful.
After the success of the descent engine firing, thoughts turned to the next big maneuver, Swigert's EVA. Everyone was concerned about Swigert's ability to accomplish the EVA. Here's how Walter Cronkite reported it.
Nelson Benton is down in Houston, Texas at the Manned Space Center. Nelson, I wonder if you've got anything late on the Schweikert nausea and how it may affect tomorrow's spacewalk.
Walter, we have two sides of the coin. We heard on air-to-ground transmission earlier the phrase used by one of the crew, I think it was McDivitt, that said, "Since we're not going to do EVA tomorrow," EVA, of course, being the acronym for a spacewalk. That was immediately followed by a report from the public affairs officer, John Riley, who said that EVA is still in the flight plan. So right now, we still have the indication of perhaps ground controllers thinking one thing and the crew thinking another. But the probability seems to be that EVA, the spacewalk, is a bridge that the controllers plan to cross when they get to it, Walter.
I gather, Nelson, that because there is a five-day pad in this flight, all of the principal parts of the mission, the test of the LEM and the extra vehicular equipment, the life support system, all is to take place in these first 5 days, or 5 days remaining. There would not be any real serious constraint to their holding off perhaps one day to be sure that Schweikert is in top-notch physical shape to make that spacewalk.
That's right, Walter. They can slip one day. The entire mission can be slipped one day. That means that the Lem will just be powered down for that period. So if there were a problem, there's still an extra 24 hours to contemplate it.
They'll be looking at that during the rest of this day, of course. The men will be in the Lem for another 5 hours or so, and then we'll be climbing back, a little less than that, climbing back into the command module for some more meals and a rest period, and then tomorrow the spacewalk.
After Swigert had vomited on two occasions, McDivitt was doubtful that the lunar module pilot would be able to handle his chores outside the spacecraft. During the EVA, Swigert was supposed to crawl out to the lunar module front porch and retrieve some science samples placed there. Then Dave Scott was to open the command module hatch, and Swigert was to traverse from the lunar module to the command module and enter it. Similar to the Russian method, transferring outside the spacecrafts. This was to demonstrate the capability of changing spacecrafts from the outside if for any reason the astronauts could not use the tunnel between the lunar module and the command module. McDivitt recommended to flight control that the EVA be limited to cabin depressurization. Flight control agreed that the extravehicular activity would consist of one daylight period, with Swigert wearing the portable life support system and the lunar module umbilical hoses, and with both the lunar module and command module hatches open. Now here is a very nice clip from NBC on the spacesuit, which is also known as the primary life support system, or PLSS.
We chatted with the man who directed the development of the spacesuit, Mr. Leonard Shepard of ILC Industries, and here now is that interview. Mr. Shepard, what's different in the suit that will be worn on this flight as against the suits that have been worn up to now in Apollo?
The basic suit is unchanged. Its function is the same. The major differences are that astronaut Swigert will have to go outside the command module in free space. In order to accomplish that safely, we have to add the protection of the thermal micrometeoroid garment, which was not on either of the two previous flights, plus the extravehicular gloves, plus the extravehicular visor assembly.
Now, all of this is to protect him from the tremendous heat of the sun, which he'll have without any protection of the spacecraft.
Yes.
And also the existence, or the supposed existence, of dust that flies around the space.
Micrometeoroids.
Which could go through a normal suit, or possibly
yes.
could.
Yes. This thermal micrometeoroid garment has the necessary bumpers to protect him from such an impact.
Well, now, what will astronaut Swigert do to protect his face and his eyes?
He has two visors here, one of which will be used during the dark portions, or on the night side. That will prevent his helmet from getting so cold that his breath will condense on the inside surface of the helmet.
The fogging problem.
Right. Then, in order to protect his face from the heat of the sun during the night, the day operations, he will pull down the second visor, which has a gold coating on it to prevent infrared radiation from penetrating.
Now he really looks like a man from Mars. How much, we're not seeing him at all. How much is he seeing on the inside?
The optical density of this system is not very different from a common pair of sunglasses. It's about 18 to 20% light transmittance.
Maybe we better pull it up so he can see a little bit more of what we're doing. How much mobility does he have, Mr. Shepard, in this kind of a suit with it all, pressure?
I think we can demonstrate that, Peter. This suit is now pressurized to the same operating pressure that he would have in space. His mobility is exactly the same as it will be in space, with the exception of the G-forces. Of course, he's at 1G here and will be at 0G. And if you'll show us what you can do.
Very important to be able to use the fingers and arms.
Yes. Another difference between this suit and the ones that flew on Apollo 7 and 8 is that the astronaut will wear underneath the suit, in place of his underwear, a liquid cooling garment, which has very small plastic tubes in it, and the backpack circulates chilled water through the tubes to help keep him cool during his extravehicular activity.
Well, he did that pretty well. Actually, if you didn't take certain precautions, I suppose you'd be rigid out there. What would it be without?
Well, I can show you that too, Peter. These two tubes are approximately the diameter of the arm of the suit, and they are both pressurized to about the same pressure. And if you'll try to bend that one, that would be what a suit would be like without any joints in it.
Impossible. I'll vouch for that.
This sample has an actual elbow joint in it, and it's also pressurized the same way, and you can see the substantial difference in effort needed.
That's the same amount as he'll have in the pressurized suit.
Yes, this is the type of joint that he has in the suit.
Now, what would happen if he bumped that helmet on some part of the spacecraft, or if he fell down?
We have a new material that is used in the helmet. I have over here two samples of material, one of which is a common acrylic or lucite. It's used in aircraft canopies and has been used in the past for helmet visors. It does have several serious disadvantages. Peter, if you'll be my guest,
I get to break this if it'll break. And it did. And this, I presume, is your new...
Yes, this is a polycarbonate material from which both the helmet and the external visor assembly is made. And I wish you'd put more effort into it than you did in the other one.
That's about as much effort as I could do. I see there are a couple of dents, but that's about all.
It's a very tough material, and it does enable us to give him the full helmet and sufficient protection that we don't have any concern about safety on the lunar surface or extravehicular.
Now, speaking of the lunar surface, I see we have other pieces of gear here. These presumably are what's going to be added still more to the suit for protection.
Right. There is no requirement for this equipment on this flight. This equipment is specifically for the lunar flight, in which when the lunar landing takes place, there will be additional radiation, thermal radiation from the lunar surface,
reflected.
In addition to the sun, reflected from the surface. To provide protection from that, we must add this thermal insulation to the extravehicular visor assembly in the back.
This goes on the back of his helmet.
Goes on the back of his helmet.
Yes.
In addition to that, the boot soles, which are used on this suit, do not have sufficient insulation for the hot lunar surface, which can go up to a temperature of about 310 degrees Fahrenheit. These lunar boots have silicone rubber soles. They are thermally insulated inside and in the ankle and are provided with abrasion protection on the side through the use of this metallic fabric, which is known as Chromel R. It's a non-flammable, in pure oxygen, very strong, high abrasion-resistant metallic
fabric.
Biggest
pair of sneakers I've ever seen. Now, if I were to go down to our local haberdashery and order a suit like this, what would it cost me?
Well, assuming that you are a qualified purchaser, and you are buying it within the same period that we are building other suits, transportation not included, we can sell you a suit certified for the moon for about $100,000.
That's all? Is that with
transportation, two pair of pants?
Transportation
is not included.
Thanks very much, Mr. Shepard.
Thank you.
On the fourth day of the flight, Swigert felt better than expected as he worked his way into the lander to get it ready for the EVA. By the time he had put on the backpack, McDivitt was ready to let him do more, to stand on the lunar lander porch at least. Mission Control told McDivitt to use his own judgment, so he fastened Swigert to the nylon cord tether that would keep him from floating away from the spacecraft. Once Swigert had entered this third spacecraft, the spacesuit, to become essentially a self-contained unit, Flight Control ran a communications check with the PLSS, as they called him. The four-way conversation between Spider, Gumdrop, PLSS, and Mission Control was much clearer than they had expected. Lunar module depressurization also went smoothly. Swigert could tell that his backpack was operating, since he could hear water gurgling while he watched his pressure indicator. He was quite comfortable. McDivitt had to use more force than he anticipated to turn the hatch latch handle and more strength to swing the hatch inside. He was very careful to keep the door pushed back, fearing it might stick closed, leaving Swigert outside. Once the lunar module hatch was opened, Scott pushed the command module hatch outward. Swigert, who now called himself Red Rover because of his rust-colored hair, enjoyed the view and did so well outside on the platform in the golden slipper's foot restraint that McDivitt decided to let him try out the handrails. Hanging on with one hand as he moved about, he took photographs and found that the handholds made everything easier than it had been in simulation, even in underwater training. Here's some audio from the EVA.
David Scott has opened the hatch of the command module, and Rusty Schweikert and Jim McDivitt in the lunar landing craft have opened the front hatch of that craft now, and very shortly Rusty Schweikert will be leaving through that hatch to the front porch. This is Rusty Schweikert speaking to Jim McDivitt.
Jim looks out the top window, he can see me. It's all the way. Just all the way, Jim. Oh, hey, I'm glad we stopped here. I pulled out my liner. Okay, I got the EVVA down. Oh, very good. Hey, Mr. Schweikert, proceed up the door. Sure, is your camera on there, Stampy? That's right. Okay. Proceeding on out. Okay. In the Golden Harbor. Oh, man, that would have come from a place. Oh, boy, what have you?
That's my papa.
Oh, there he is. There's a moon right over there. So we don't have the, Okay, why don't you just throw out the Okay, it's made easy for a while. I have a nice reflection off the, The day you read. Okay, I read you just fine. Are you doing relay now?
That's right.
Okay, good.
Why don't you, say hello to the camera or something?
Hello there, camera.
LOS at Huntsville. Rusty Schweikert out in the golden slippers on the front porch of the limb.
Saturn Gumdrop, we have you through Redstone, and we've been copying you loud and clear.
Very good, Houston. Everything's going along fine up here.
Roger, we copied you all across Carnarvon and Huntsville real well. We've been calling you, and it sounds great.
Okay. Do you have anything special that you want done in this pass?
No, it might be one to poke the TV camera out there.
I will, as soon as he passes the camera out to you.
Okay. Jimmy, you ready for this camera?
Yeah.
Okay, haul away.
Okay. Rod, just to let you know, that sounds great, and you're clear to go as far as you want to, as far as work is done.
Okay. How about the time limit? How are you feeling, Rusty?
I'm doing fine.
Schweikert says he's feeling fine.
Did you want to go ahead and try to run the thing for the day passes and the one night pass? Looks like we might be able to do that for you.
Jim, that's your decision. It's up to you. It's all go without it.
Okay, the thing that bothers me is that if it does, we may have to reconsider how we're going to do that rendezvous tomorrow. We're going to have to get some sleep here sometime.
Rod, we got it. We got it.
Well, think it over and see what you decide.
Okay. And Spider, this is Houston. We're recommending that you terminate at the end of this daylight pass.
Okay, I sort of felt that way too. I don't think we're going to try that transfer for sure. All right, we'll terminate here.
Okay, Dave, come on out.
Okay. I'll have the camera right here.
Dave, come on out wherever you are.
Stand by, let me put away my little push button.
We're talking about Dave Scott sticking his head out of the command module.
Yeah, you want to retrieve a sample?
Right, that's a good idea.
Okay, Dave, let me get around here and I can get a picture, too.
Okay,
Rusty, why don't you pass the camera back in here and work on the handrails up there for just a minute.
Can you stand by one? The change film packs here.
Okay, here comes the camera. Hey, just a minute, let me get this other one zipped in.
Yeah.
And take it easy out there. I don't want you getting there.
Okay,
that's fine. Rusty?
Yes, sir.
Stand by.
Houston, this is Red River. If you read, I'm just going to call you in the blind here. The suit's very comfortable. I'm on min cooling, and I haven't had any problem at all. The only thing that's warm at all are my hands, and they're just barely warm. They're not really hot at all.
Roger, Red Rover, this is Houston. We're reading you loud and clear. We're copying all transmissions.
Rusty, why don't you exercise the handrails a little bit just to see how they work, and don't go very far up, and if Dave gets a picture flying, if it doesn't, well, I just dip.
Okay.
I think it's going to go 90 degrees to that way, Dave.
Yeah. Put it on down there and lock it. Dave, you take a picture yet?
I can't get to run now, would you believe?
Okay, heck with it then.
It can kind of smashed around a little bit, too. I heard these cameras are good for one film pack, and that's about it when you're doing work like this with them. But Steve, I want you to evaluate those handles, and when you get through with it, I want a conclusion from you on whether or not
It's a practical way of doing it, like we've already said it is.
Okay.
This is no problem at all. Okay, go on back down it again.
Almost no disturbing torque. I mean, I don't have any problem at all just maintaining myself wherever I want.
Okay, Rusty, why don't you start coming back in?
All right, chilling in.
As anticipated, Swikert did not go over and visit Scott in the command module, but both pilots retrieved experimental samples from the spacecraft hulls. Scott and Swikert also took pictures of each other, like tourists in a strange country. The EVA was originally scheduled to last more than 2 hours, but it ended in less than one, partly because they did not want to tire Swikert after his illness, and partly because they had plenty to do to get ready for the next day's activity. The key event of the entire mission, the separation and rendezvous of the lunar module and the command module. With the door closed and their life-sustaining outside equipment off, McDivitt and Swikert recharged the backpack, tidied up the cabin, and returned to the command module. Salutations from Chocolate Land, Hershey, Pennsylvania. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 182 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Apollo 9 Lunar Module Maneuvers Part 3. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed, and I want to extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. There are a lot of you out there. I'm glad you are here. Make sure you sign up for the email list and connect with me on Twitter and Facebook. You can do all that by going to the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. Today, we salute the Soyuz-level donors, of which there are 14 so far this year. Soyuz donors give $30 or more during the year. Thanks for your continued support, Soyuz donors. Had a couple of afterthoughts this week. This episode was recorded in between dog barking sessions here at the campground. Hope you didn't hear the barking. I just had to wait for the right moment in between barks to do my speaking. I heavily edited that EVA clip, trying to get the most important events covered. The actual EVA lasted around 38 minutes, and I cut the audio to about 5 minutes. Did you catch early in this episode Walter Cronkite explaining that the lunar module could be used as a backup or a lifeboat? Now that was some very relative information that might come up again sometime. I hope you enjoyed that spacesuit clip. They of course considered the suit or the PLSS as the third spacecraft. I really enjoyed that suit clip. Okay. I posted some pictures and audio for this episode on the website, spacerockethistory.com. I hope you check that out. I was pleased to receive one donation to support the podcast over the past week. Rebecca M. from Tennessee donated at the Mercury level. Thank you, Rebecca. Our total on Patreon remains at 75, and our overall donors for the year are now at 175, with a goal of reaching 250. By the end of 2016. For those of you who have not donated yet, there is still time. Please keep in mind Space Rocket History is entirely listener supported, and I depend upon your financial support to keep the podcast going. If you are enjoying the podcast and can afford to help, please do so. To make a one-time donation, go to the homepage spacerockethistory.com and click on the orange donate button on the top right of the page. Or you could sign up with Patreon by clicking on the Patreon link also on the homepage, just below the donate button. This past week I had a listener from France that was having trouble with the Patreon donation, and I want to remind everybody, if you ever have trouble donating, please let me know. Shoot me an email, mike@spacerockethistory.com, and I will try to get everything straightened out. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page at the website, spacerockethistory.com. based on their donation level. Donors that donate 2 years in a row receive the rocket emoji, and those who have donated 3 years in a row receive the treasured moon emoji next to their name on the donors list. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who've already done so, like my retweeters. As of Sunday, the 23rd, 1202 Alarm, Bert at Home, Buddy P. Murphy, B-Con 63, David B. Nugent, Duke of Oil 60, Futurama King, Gaddafi 1202, Keith Drinkwine, KHS Astronomy, M. Lunyon, Pee-wee 888, Rapid Mustang, Rocket Noob, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, The Rocketry Show, this is Alex Boyd, and WNC Max. I really appreciate it. If I missed anyone, let me know and I will get you next week. This is the end of the content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to your next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will continue with Apollo 9 Lunar Module Maneuvers. In podcast news, we have already set another record in episode downloads for the month of October. In listener news, I got a comment on a very old episode asking what happened to Deke Slayton. Why was he not flying? And I thought I had covered that in other episodes, but if I didn't, I don't mind covering it again right now. The reason is back in 1962, the doctors discovered that he had an irregular heart rhythm. But he did eventually fly on the Apollo-Soyuz test project. Moving on, in personal news, as I mentioned before, we are now in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Before we left New York, we did have a chance to visit former President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park. Now, that was a very interesting visit. They have a nice setup there. His estate was apparently donated to the National Park Service, and they've done a lot of wonderful things over there. We got to go inside his mansion, and obviously it was very impressive, and you could see the age of everything and really how things have held up pretty well. We also saw his grave, which was located in his mother's rose garden. And then as we looked around the estate some more, we found a monument, and it had a couple sections of the Berlin Wall there. So, if you're ever in the area, I can recommend wholeheartedly to go visit Hyde Park. Well, I'm constantly on search for the source of more Wi-Fi. I've almost used up my Verizon 10 gigabyte that I bought for $100. Now, I really hope I can find some cheaper Wi-Fi around at the next spot we go to, because this Verizon, it works. But wow, is it expensive. Anyway, that's about all the time I have for this week. Hope to have episode 183 up by next Thursday. So long for now.